You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show. A pleasure to be with you on this Friday, December 2nd. Looking forward later in this hour to my guest, Dr. Jessica McFarland. She is a physician in the realm of palliative care, and we're going to be talking about that. Hopefully, what is palliative care, why it matters, what are some of the misconceptions and so forth, and we look forward to having Jessica on the program. You know her husband, Jason Hall. He's been a regular guest on the show for the last 7 years, and he and Jessica married a little over 6 months now, so look forward to having her on and talking about something that's very near and dear to her. And like I said, anybody who's been in pain, palliative care, or had a loved one suffer, you know what it's all about. So we'll look forward to having that conversation a little bit later. We're also going to talk about cartoon parents today, an interesting piece from one of my favorite film critics and Deacon Stephen Graydonis. We'll talk about his recent article. We'll also spin the Dial of Catechism wheel and look back in history a little bit, all that and more on the program today. If you want to be a part of it, I'm asking the question of the day, since we're talking about palliative care. What is the most physically painful thing that you've ever endured, and what brought you relief? 573-4-BREAD-4. 573-4-BREAD-4, the most physically painful, right? So clarifying that, so that, you know, if you want to write heartbreak, okay, I understand that, but we're talking, yeah, and I know you can feel it to a certain degree, but a friend of mine, by the way, put listening to one of Mike's sermons at Park United Methodist Church, where I used to be pastor before I became Catholic in 2005. But then he made it all better by just saying, just kidding, right? Physically painful. I knew I thought my sermons were more anesthetizing, not so much pain-inducing. But I guess you learn something new every day. Like I said, 573-4-BREAD-4, you can call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a remark on Facebook or on Twitter. Some of the responses we've gotten said to Alan Alday, through the top three responses on social media that I'm getting seem to be labor pains solved typically by an epidural, dry sockets from wisdom teeth, which seem to be more common than I realized. My daughter had that a few years ago and still talks about the agony it caused, and then kidney stones. Of course, my friend John, who served in Iraq, says gunshot and morphine. So we probably have to give John the winner of the thread there for the day. But anyway, if you want to chime in, 573-4-BREAD-4, you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Hope you had a good rest of your day yesterday. I got to enjoy, had a couple of interesting experiences. I teach my one class at the local Catholic high school, and it's an Old Testament class. And we're trying to cover in fairly short order the wisdom literature, the wisdom books, which start with Job and go through the book of wisdom, Wisdom of Solomon, seven books there. And then we'll be covering, starting today, the prophets. We got about a week to cover the prophets. I like it like a true the Genesis nerd, probably spending an inordinate amount of time on that book since it is my favorite. So now we're having to make up a little ground to get through the whole Old Testament in one semester. But yesterday we were talking about the Song of Songs, that book tucked neatly right into the middle of the scripture, which is comprised primarily, really, of love poetry. And not just love poetry between a bride and a groom and a groom and a bride, but erotic love poetry. And so I teach seniors, and there's I chose, I guess you could say, the most benign chapter
that I encountered and chapter two, and had them read back and forth. Because if you go to the book of Song of Songs, and if you don't believe me, if you've never read Song of Songs, go read it. It's amazing how graphic it is. And we were reading what I had them do, because you can see in the text of a lot of versions that they've got them identified, which verses are said by the woman and which are said by the man. Of course, this attributed to King Solomon and I guess one of his many brides. And so I had, as a group, I had the women read the verses designated for women and the men read the verses designated for men. So started out simple enough, you know, I'm a flower of Sharon, the girl said, a lily of the valleys. And then the young men, the boys said, like a lily among thorns, so is my friend among women. And it goes on from there, you know, the sound of my lover, here he comes, springing across the mountains. My lover's like a gazelle or a young stag. So you could feel the flush in the face of them as they were reading this. Like I said, I kept them away from some of the juicier chapters, but it is an amazing book. And you know, part of what I was helping them understand is it's a book that needs to be understood on several levels, right? It's a celebration of romantic love, the love of a husband and a wife for her husband, and written into our human nature from the very beginning. If you read the early chapters of Genesis, and God created us male and female in his image, and the man and his wife were naked without shame, and they became one flesh, and God declared it all very, very good. So there's a great beauty and a richness in erotic love. It's not something we thought up. But of course, the believers over the millennia, really, and this is before the time of Christ, also saw it on another level, the allegorical level of the love of God for his people, which the deeper you get, and we'll talk about this as we get into the prophets, the deeper you get into the Old Testament prophets, you see of all the analogies for God's relationship with his people, whether God's the father and they're the children, God's the king, they're the nation, God's the lawmaker, they're the obedient servants, and so forth. God's the master, they're the slaves. The analogy that begins to triumph the deeper you get into the prophets is the spousal analogy, the marital analogy. That God's love for his people is like that of a husband for his bride, and vice versa. And it's a love that in that relationship is marked by betrayal, Israel's own hard-heartedness and inconsistency and infidelity and idolatry and all the rest. And yet God's continued fidelity in bringing them back to himself. Of course, this all is consummated in the incarnation. Christ, whose first miracle was at a wedding, who told countless parables about weddings, and who gave himself in his great gift of self on the cross, his donation of his body for his bride, the church. So this is a rich theme. So we had a good time with that yesterday. And then last night, sticking with the Old Testament, teaching this young adult Bible study that I've been teaching in the book of Genesis, and we were getting into the story of Abram. Abram, starting in Genesis 12, the patriarch called by God to follow, to go to a place that the Lord himself will show him. You see Abram for all of his strengths, and you see him for all of his warts as well. There in chapter 12, he responds in obedience to the Lord's call, the Lord's promise. And as I reminded them last night, don't forget the fact that when Abram received this call from God, there was no church, there was no scripture. You know, there was no biblical history that he had to draw from. All this is happening in real time. And so his response of obedience is pretty remarkable. But then he goes down to Egypt, and we see his own lack of faith, his own concern for self-preservation, when he has his beautiful wife, Sarah, tell officials there that she's actually Abram's sister, so that Pharaoh won't kill him to take her into his harem. He takes her anyway, and all kind of things unfold. So you see the good and the bad of Abram, the strength and the weakness, the real human stuff from which God is going about doing his redemptive work. But then you have this beautiful passage in Genesis 15 in which God swears a covenant to Abram. Abram, who wonders, how can I know for sure that this promise to make my descendants so numerous and that you're going to give me this land and all these things you've promised to do, and as time has gone by, how can I know you'll be true to your word? And so God, who has no obligation to anyone, God, who by his very nature is God, swears a promise by his own self to Abram. He has him cut these animals in half, a pretty graphic scene, and separate the pieces. And then Abram has a vision of a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passing in between the pieces as God swears a promise. It's God swearing by himself, saying in essence, if I don't keep my promise, may I be torn asunder as these beasts have been. Why would God, who needs nothing, is obligated to no one, who is all powerful, why would he make a promise? Why would he swear by himself to Abram like that? Why would he make covenant with him? Because God is love, and love makes promises. No one forces love to make promises. God makes promises. And the promise that we yearn for, the fullness of what he's given us a foretaste of in Jesus' incarnation, his life, death, and resurrection, and the fullness of hope to which our hearts are oriented this Advent season. Our confidence is not in any other circumstance except for the fact that God is love and love never fails. We'll be back with more with my good friend, Dr. Jessica McFarland. We'll talk about palliative care. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, you're back on The Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to learn more about Breadbox Media? Just go to breadboxmedia.com. You can find out all about our different show hosts, different topics, contributors from every corner of the country and across the heartland, each some with weekly shows, some with daily shows, various topics, temperaments, senses of humor, all the rest, all through the common lens of the Catholic faith, because the Catholic faith is the whole truth. There is nothing not impacted by this coherence of the truth. So check it out. You can listen to podcasts of shows that you want to investigate, or shows that you've missed, like this one, through Podbean, Google Play, or iTunes. You can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. You can also become a friend of your favorite show. Appreciate all those who are a friend of this show and who support it. Financially, appreciate that very much, and they get exclusive access to online content. It's all at breadboxmedia.com. In just a few minutes, we're going to be welcoming into the studio Dr. Jessica McFarland. Let me go ahead and get the bio out of the way here. Jessica McFarland, MD, is the chief of the University of Kentucky's Division of Palliative and Supportive Care in the Department of Internal Medicine. She received her medical degree from the University of Kentucky and then completed her residency and dual fellowship training at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. She's board certified in neurology and hospice and palliative medicine by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. She's also board certified in neurocritical care. We're going to be talking about palliative medicine and why it's important. Just also, Jessica, on a personal note, Jessica married to Jason Hall. Jason, who has been a regular guest on the program, the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky, and they married in May. And Jessica, who had been at Duke University for a number of years, now transferring back to her home state of Kentucky, where she is. And we're going to talk some, as I said, about palliative care today. If you wonder what palliative care is, it is specialized medical care for people with serious illnesses.
It focuses on providing relief from the symptoms and stress of a serious illness, and the goal is to improve quality of life for both the patient and the family. It's provided by specially trained teams of doctors, nurses, social workers, and other specialists who work together with the patient's doctors to provide an extra layer of support. It is appropriate at any age and at any stage in serious illness and can be provided along with curative treatment. So, Jessica, slip it in here now. We'll get her on the air. We'll talk about this a little bit. It's very important, I think, as a topic because nobody likes to be in pain. Pain can be a very debilitating thing, and so to have physicians who are dedicated to addressing that is crucial. So push that right up to you there, Jessica. Jessica, good morning.
Good morning. I have an excuse for being late, though it's not a valid excuse. My windows were iced over this morning, which wouldn't have happened if I was in North Carolina. So, so I wasn't prepared. So I had to scrape it off with my driver's license.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, yeah, that's, you know, let's get just a little bit closer there. There we go. The being in North Carolina, you would not be in the state of the number one ranked basketball team. Now, would you?
That is true. And I never became a Duke fan. I always feel guilty whenever somebody mentions that I was in Duke for 10 years because people go, oh, we hate that. But I was actually, I couldn't cheer for them at all. I would try and then they'd start to lose and I'd get so excited that I was like, no, I should have known all along I was going to come back.
They were writing your checks, though.
They were. So I can't say bad things about them. I can only say I couldn't cheer for them. But
there you go.
They did write a lot of checks. It was good.
Well, it is an honor to have you here.
Thank you.
We've had your lesser half on the program many, many times.
Yes.
And he's in Washington, D.C. right now, so, right?
Right. He's at his annual conference up there, so he's with his tribe.
With his tribe. And you know, y'all just had, I think, your six-month anniversary.
We did. We did have it on the 21st. It was 21st of November. It was 6 months.
The first time I met you was when you came on the marriage preparation weekend, I think,
right.
You and Jason together. And
right.
You still decided you wanted to be married after that experience, which was a good thing.
It was. You know, it was funny. We actually did that before we were. Oh, I think we did that after we were engaged. But we started doing some of the marriage prep work with our deacon before we were engaged because we sort of wanted to get the basics before
sure.
we decided to make that decision and make sure that we weren't overlooking things. We'd known each other for a long time, but I'm glad we did it that way. It just gave us a sense of peace about moving forward in that direction.
Yeah, longtime friends back from your days at a Baptist college.
Right, right. I think almost 20 years we've known each other.
Fantastic.
Not quite, but getting close.
Well, let's talk about palliative care because I know this is something obviously that you work in, but it's a good combination. You work in it and you're very passionate about it. I kind of gave a little brief textbook sort of definition of what palliative care is. What drew you to palliative care, you know, when you were going through medical school and your training and all the rest?
So it wasn't something that I saw until I got pretty far into my residency training. And my residency training was in neurology. So I was seeing a lot of patients that had pretty debilitating illnesses that we couldn't necessarily cure. We could maintain and we could make better and we could work on symptoms, but we really couldn't cure things like strokes or multiple sclerosis or things like that. So I saw a lot of patients that had a lot of symptoms. And then as it is in medicine, a lot of times you go into a specific field because you see another doctor that does something great and you go, oh, I want to do that. And I fell in love with two things. So the first thing I fell in love with was the intensive care unit. I loved the teamwork of the ICU. I loved taking care of patients that were critically ill. I loved working with families of patients that were critically ill. And then I met a palliative care physician pretty early on and I loved what he did too. And it was pretty similar. It was working with families that had a life-changing diagnosis. It was really paying really careful attention to symptoms. But to me, I sort of thought you had to pick one, that I would either have to go the ICU route where we were dedicated to improving function, saving lives, being really, really aggressive, or I would have to go the opposite route in palliative care, which at the time I thought that's going to be a lot of breaking bad news and deciding not to do aggressive things. And when I was talking to one of my mentors, he said, oh my goodness, we need somebody that does both. He was an ICU physician. I said, what do you mean both? He said, we use palliative care every day in the ICU. And we use it for folks that maybe not necessarily aren't going to get a cure, but that we want to make sure that their families are taken care of, that their symptoms are taken care of. And he admitted to me, he said, we don't know how to do that very well. We're not really good at it. So if we had someone in our unit that did both, that would be a great addition to our team. So then the light bulb came on and I decided to do both fellowships. And now once I'm doing it, I realize there's more and more people every year deciding to sort of do palliative care in addition to some other sort of training to bring those skills to what their primary job as a physician is. I happen to do both, so I have times where I'm just on the palliative care side of things, and then I have other times where I'm on the stroke and ICU times. And they always overlap, but I get to do two jobs a lot of times, which is really great.
So you deal with people in very difficult circumstances. I mean, I guess that takes a particular temperament, a typical empathy, I guess, for people, you know, because, you know, it's not like, you know, dealing with run-of-the-mill type stuff. I mean, you're dealing with people who are in maybe grave circumstances, who perhaps they have a terminal illness, or I think it's especially maybe of people who see loved ones who are suffering, which is, I think, a very, very hard thing.
Right.
So I guess it takes a particular temperament as a physician to deal with that.
I think so. I think you have to recognize when there's times to be empathic. You have to sort of understand mm-hmm. that there's a lot of emotional suffering that patients and their families are having, and that you can't just focus on sort of the cognitive medical part. I can tell you all about your disease and about your prognosis mm-hmm. and about what medicines will work and which medicines won't. But if I don't recognize that before you can think about what sort of treatments you might want, we've got to deal with the emotional side of it and really bring a lot of empathy to the job. So I think that's what makes palliative care a little bit different than traditional medicine. I mean, it is traditional medicine. It's not alternative or special in any way, but that's sort of what we get trained as palliative care providers, is to recognize those empathic moments and stop and put the hard medicine aside and say, let's talk about this and how this affects you and how this affects your families and what are you scared of? What are you worried about? And figure out what people's goals and values are. So then to go back and really do the medicine that's appropriate, that matches patients' goals and values.
Yeah, I like that a lot. You know, I've had on the show a couple of times Dr. Wes Ely, who you're familiar with,
yes,
you know, down
yes.
at Vanderbilt. And he talks about that, you know, as a physician, he wants to listen to people. Now, he's not, I don't think, necessarily always in palliative care, but he does want to hear from people, you know, do you have convictions? Do you have values
right.
that should guide me in the way that I treat you? I'm sure not everybody takes that approach as a physician, so... That sounds like a real blessing.
Yeah, it is. And I think we get taught that in medical school. And other providers do, too. Palliative care, we have nurses, we have social workers, we have chaplains. And we all sort of get taught that in our training, to think about someone's goals and values. But medicine is so complex compared to mm-hmm. 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So you sort of get on one train, if you will, and sort of stay on that train, whatever train you decide with your physician to be on. And in order to take really good care of patients, you have to know all of those complexities. You have to understand imaging and what the state-of-the-art tests are that you can do, or the newest trials. And it's hard to keep up with all that and be a really good physician and remember those basics of what you learned in medical school about attending to the needs of the family and the patient. So it's hard to do it all. And I think that's how palliative care has sort of grown as a specialty, is we really focus on remembering how to use those skills and honing those skills, because it's hard. It's not easy to talk about how a disease affects someone. So it's not just innate. You have to actually learn skills to do that and learn how to talk to people about what worries them about their illnesses.
Well, we're almost out of time for this segment. Time always flies by, and so we'll pick this up on the other side. But I want to talk a little bit more about this, and particularly about, you know, maybe talking about this. I guess what I'm saying is it's important to talk about this before you're in pain. Right?
Yes, yeah, before you get into trouble.
Because that's when all of a sudden rationality kind of goes out the window, because when you hurt, yes. you know. So we'll be back in just a minute. If you got a question for my guest, Dr. Jessica McFarland, 573-4-BREAD-4. We'll be back. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Bottom of the hour, back on The Mike Allen Show on this December 2nd. Blessed to have in the studio with us Jessica McFarland.
Jessica is an MD and heads up the palliative care department at the University of Kentucky. I had your official bio up here a minute ago, Jessica, and now I can't find it. Anyway, you heard Lester have Jason Hall as a regular guest on the program, but Jessica is chief, there we go, of the University of Kentucky Division of Palliative and Supportive Care in the Department of Internal Medicine. So let's get back into it a little bit, Jessica. We were talking before the break, the time to think about, I guess, palliative care is not first when you're in pain, because, you know, I think when people are in pain, or I think even especially when they have a loved one who's in pain, that there's a desperate feeling when you're a family member in that situation, particularly maybe if you're a parent at your child, yes, or, you know, somebody that you love and you see them hurting and there's something you want to be able to do and you just can't do it. And, you know, you maybe start to even get angry and feel like nobody else, you know, the medical staff isn't doing all they can do. And that's not the time to think about palliative care. It's when you're not in that situation, I would imagine.
Right. I think you're right. When you get into sort of crisis, you start to make decisions that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise. And that applies to anything, not
sure,
just illness. And, you know, I talk a lot about palliative care from the inpatient hospital perspective, because that's sort of where I live. But palliative care actually comes really upstream in an illness. So really early on is when we're trying to encourage people to think about adding palliative care practices to their overall medical illness. So some of those are for chronic illnesses, like things like heart failure or COPD or cancer, where you may not have a prognosis that's short. You may have a prognosis of years. You may even have an ability to be cured of the cancer, but you have a lot of symptoms. So talking really early on to your primary care provider or your primary specialty provider, a cardiologist or an oncologist about, you know, it's really important to me to control my symptoms. Mm. And some primary care providers and primary specialty providers are really good at symptom management, especially oncologists who know that their patients have a big burden of illness. But others aren't as comfortable. And there are outpatient palliative care providers as well that you can see in addition to your regular provider. One of the misconceptions is that you have to choose either sort of going big and going home and going for the cure or palliative care. And it's actually, we're just an extra layer of support. So we work right alongside those other providers, regardless of prognosis, regardless of whether or not you want to be really, really aggressive. We see a lot of patients that are really aggressive in their care, and we support that because that matches up with their goals and values. And we can get right in at the beginning and keep people from getting into pain trouble, keep people from having such a big burden that they may not want to go forward.
So you can even have, I guess, because there are some, you know, sometimes we say things like, you know, what's going to kill you, the disease or the cure.
Right.
I mean, sometimes the treatment itself can bring in its own pain circumstances. And I guess palliative care has to work on that as well.
Yeah, it's really great for patients that have are undergoing chemotherapy. Chemotherapies have a really big symptom burden: nausea, loss of appetite, fatigue, pain. It's kind of socially isolating as well. So getting palliative care on board can treat all of those symptoms really, really, really well. And we get creative about it too. A lot of times it may not be just medicines, but it might be a procedure that somebody needs. So we work closely with people in fields like anesthesia to do things like nerve blocks if someone has a particularly painful area. We think about procedures that maybe people can go home with, a pain pump or something like that. So we try to think outside of the box to keep people comfortable and keep their symptoms treated and keep people at home, because most people want to be enjoying their lives, mm-hmm, not suffering from pain. So we work side by side by those doctors.
Hmm. I know there are a lot of misconceptions too about palliative care. And I know particularly, you know, a lot of Catholics, when they think about end of life issues and their concerns about you know, euthanasia, you know, and all those sort of things, they kind of bleed in.
Right.
It's important for people to really understand, you know, not just what palliative care is and what it's about, but also, you know, that the Catholic faith is affirming of palliative care as something that is consonant, I guess, with the dignity of the human person.
Right. It's even, Jason and I will play this game. We play Dial a Catechism on our own.
So you all are such geeks.
I know, we're giant nerds, right? I can't help it. But especially as I've sort of been coming into the faith and learning about the church, I've read a lot of the catechism. So it was exciting for me to open that up and see actually palliative care mentioned in the catechism. I was like, whoa, how many people actually have their profession written out for them and identified as important to the life of a Catholic? And it is. Palliative care isn't choosing to not have medical therapy that could save your life or choosing to end a life. It's not physician-assisted suicide. It's in fact, in some ways, sort of the answer to that, the way to avoid sort of having to make decisions where it may lead down a path of choosing to end one's life. It's very aggressive attention to symptoms and exquisite management of your goals and values. And it goes right alongside sort of care of the whole person from birth to a natural death.
Did it surprise you? I mean, somebody who didn't grow up Catholic, right? I mean, I know you've been a Baptist most of your life and serious about your faith. And like me, probably didn't know a lot about Catholicism per se. Did that surprise you to see that kind of thought that had gone into an issue like palliative care?
Oh, I was floored. I think I've always known, and those of us that are in palliative care really value the role of someone's faith in their life, but I've never really knew that it was really thought about mm-hmm. and valued and specifically defined in Catholicism. I had no idea. And it's pretty new. It's not, I mean, the values of palliative care, and we've been practicing palliative care since the beginning of medicine, but to actually recognize it as needed in someone's, as part of someone's journey of illness was surprising to me and exciting.
One of the things I know that gets talked a lot about when it gets into Catholic, you know, with just bioethics and end of life is this question of proportionality, you know, in terms of benefit
right.
versus cost and all that sort of thing. And that's on a whole host of levels, not just medicine. Pain medicine, but also hydration, nutrition, all those sorts of things. And so kind of walk us through that just a little bit, maybe the kind of questions that people need to think about when they get in those circumstances, or maybe even how alert I want to be. You know, I've got a friend who's dying, right? Mm-hmm. So he's in such great pain that the level of pain medication, he's pretty much almost comatose, but it's just where he has to be right now. Mm-hmm. But there are decisions that have to be made there too.
Yeah, and I think one thing we don't do a great job of when patients do have a terminal illness is talking to the patient or talking to their caregivers, their families, about what dying looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard for us, especially in America, to talk about that because I think our culture sort of wants to put that off and sometimes wants to put it off at all costs so that we've lost sight of the fact that it's actually a pretty natural part of living is the dying process. And it's something most people don't know about. So we spend a lot of time talking about what does it look like to die from a certain disease? What does it look like to die with dementia? What does it look like to die with terminal cancer or from heart failure? And we talk about things like the body sort of turning into itself, not needing as much food and hydration, needing more symptom management just at the end of life because the body loses some of its own ability to take care of itself. And how do you balance that with this fear that maybe you're ending someone's life prematurely? And I think when we talk about it openly and we talk about what it looks like to die and we sort of normalize it and let families know how to take care of the dying patient, that helps people understand that proportionality, if you were, that idea of double effect, that we're going to treat these symptoms and sometimes that may make someone sleepier. Sometimes we're not going to keep giving hydration or food if it's hurting the body and causing a lot of symptoms and no longer promoting life. And counseling about that and knowing what to look for can be really reassuring to caregivers so that you don't feel like that last dose of medicine you gave someone was what ended their life, or stopping IV fluids in someone with overwhelming fluid buildup is shortening their life, but it's actually creating a relief of symptoms.
Well, and that, because I think one of the biggest misconceptions of a lot of Catholics, and this is where we really have to do a better job of educating and catechizing within the church, is people think that because the Catholic Church, of course, is, you know, it's just firmly rooted in the dignity of life and opposed to any intentional killing of a human person, of an innocent human person. We would never seek to kill, you know, someone directly. But that doesn't mean that a Catholic is obligated to do everything possible to extend life. It is appropriate at times to say to let death run its course. It's moving toward that, and it's even permissible to apply pain medication that is not seeking the death of the person, seeking to relieve pain, even though that you can see that it's possible that could hasten their death. It's a whole question of what's intended and what's sought, and I just think a lot of people are ignorant about that, or maybe, as you've said, they have this idea we're waiting for a miracle.
Right. And I never take away a miracle. One of the great things about medicine is I can say with confidence is if a miracle is going to occur, it's not going to occur because of something I'm doing. I'm not that good of a doctor. No one is. But that's where using things like a hospice organization at the end of life or having a physician that you trust to talk about, what does dying look like? Is this dying? And how can I know the difference between choosing care that may shorten someone's life but relieve symptoms at the same time versus making choices to end someone's life with something that's not relieving a symptom, and that there's a difference between the two. And just talking about that and educating families about what that looks like, I think can be helpful and not feel like you're not letting a miracle happen because you're treating symptoms, or not letting a miracle happen because you decide to no longer use chemotherapy when the oncologist have said this isn't going to help anymore, that it's okay to stop those things.
Out of time for this segment. Can you stick around for a few more minutes? Okay, we'll be back in just a minute with Jessica McFarland. If you got a question or a comment, 573-4-BREAD-4. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday with my good friend Dr. Jessica McFarland, Chief of the University of Kentucky's Division of Palliative and Supportive Care in the Department of Internal Medicine. If you listen to the program for any length of time, you know her husband Jason Hall is a regular guest on the program since the beginning. Jessica, he's been a long term.
I know you've monthly. kept him around.
7 years. It must be the big paycheck he's getting.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's why he does it. He's really excited. And no, but it's actually, you know, the first time I heard the show, I was actually listening because I was listening to Jace's. I'm sorry, I'm biased. But it was great because I listen to you now almost every single day. So oftentimes I'll say, did you hear this on Mike's show? And I'll tell Jason about it before he knows about it. So it keeps me up to date.
Well, now I'm blushing. Thank you so much for listening. No, it's great to have you here. And we've been talking some about, palliative care. You know, one of the things I was asking you off the air is, you know, are there circumstances as a palliative care physician? I mean, one of the things you said, you know, was if a miracle is going to happen, I'm not going to do it. I mean, that part of being a physician, I'm sure there's a degree of humility. As much as we know, I think one of the things that we realize more and more is that medicine can do a lot, but there are certain things that are beyond us, you know, at this point. Do you find situations, levels of pain in persons that palliative care simply cannot help?
I do. There are, you know, there's a lot of different types of suffering. Sometimes it's physical pain, and you get to a point where you realize that you're going to have to make a decision between continuing to treat somebody's pain and having them be awake and alert and participatory with their family, or using medications to help treat the pain that also might cause them to be less conscious or to be asleep, and using more things like some things you might use in anesthesia to sort of help with that. And that's something we try to talk about beforehand, is what's more important to a patient. Is it to be comfortable or to sort of be awake and alert, and we have to balance that very carefully. But we have very careful ways to assess how much medicine we're using and make certain that we're using it to treat a symptom and not simply to stop all suffering or to end someone's life. And we actually pay really careful attention to that. But there's other types of suffering, too, that palliative care tries to to help with, and that might be more existential suffering. Someone that has great fear of dying or great fear of stopping treatment, or family members sometimes that just don't understand why God would take somebody, why God would end someone's life. You see this especially in pediatrics, or someone that's losing an adult child, or even people losing their parents. So we have a multidisciplinary team. We have chaplains on our team. We have social workers on our team. And we'll use other resources to try to help with that other suffering, too, that you can't always treat with just medication or just procedures, just pure what people think of as sort of medicine.
Have you been surprised as a physician? You've been you've been out of medical school how long now?
11 years.
Have you been surprised at how many times you find yourself in a situation where it's not your medical expertise that is needed? It's just your personal kindness or, you know, spiritual support or whatever that you can give a patient.
I am. And it's sort of that presence. We call it holding space with somebody is a term people use, you know. And I really like being able to sit down and spend 30 minutes or an hour if it needs at somebody's bedside, and learning the practice of being silent, that oftentimes people are asking a question that doesn't really need a response. You know, they're asking me, can they get this treatment, or are they going to survive? And they don't really need my answer. They already know the answer, but being able to just be with that person and be present is really, really important. And oftentimes we don't get that time in medicine. And that's one of the things I really like about palliative care, is we build that time into our time with patients.
That's fantastic. You know, we were talking a little bit about some of the misconceptions and some of the thinking that the Catholic Church has done on this issue. And we mentioned that, you know, here's a quote. I posted a link to this on the show's Facebook page, along with a link to the website that you sent my way, getpalliativecare.org. I posted this link to, this was Catholic Insight, Palliative Care from a Catholic Moral Perspective. And it says that it was actually Venerable Pope Pius XII who first justified the use of pain medication in the terminally ill, even if the person's life may be shortened as a result. And then in Evangelium Vitae, Pope St. John Paul II said, and I quote, "In such a case, use of painkillers and sedatives, death is not willed or sought, even though for reasonable motives one runs the risk of it. There's simply a desire to ease pain effectively by using the analgesics which medicine provides." So, you know, that we don't have to be afraid of treating the pain out of the fear that there may be a secondary negative result.
Right, right. And I think, you know, when we talk about end-of-life care, it affects the whole person, it affects the whole family. And there is suffering, and there's pain, and it's a hard journey to go through, but there's also a beauty in that to be able to sort of call it what it is and recognize what's going on and sit through that, because we can't relieve all suffering. And certainly there are lessons to be learned from suffering and sometimes rejoicing in types of suffering, but balancing what we can treat with what we can is really, really important.
I guess we have to be in that fine line between, at the one hand, not seeing suffering as simply always a negative to be avoided,
right,
you know, but at the same time, not glamorizing suffering either as well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, that to be careful to find the balance between that, to know that there's lessons in both.
Do you find people sometimes who almost, you know, they almost think it's a sign of weakness for them to want palliative care?
Certainly some people will, they minimize their symptoms a lot for a wide variety of reasons. People don't like to admit they hurt. I see that more in the palliative care side, not so much at the end of life, but people that are maybe afraid of opioids. I love it when, you know, I'll have someone who's 86 years old and he'll tell me, my grandfather was like this, I'm afraid to get addicted. I'm like, well, you broke your leg, you know, like, let me treat that. So I see a lot of that. I see a lot of people that maybe that don't want to admit that they want help sometimes. Or I see people, a lot of times what I see is people think that having palliative care means they're not fighting, that they're not a fighter. And we talk a lot about cancer in terms of not stopping the fight or being a fighter. Mm-hmm. So people feel that if they choose palliative care, that they're not fighting. And what I want to encourage people is not to think of palliative care as one or the other, but and with. That we're adding the idea of palliative care and symptom management along to your fight, and it's going to help you fight. And there was a great study that was done in Boston medical center in Harvard, where they looked at patients with lung cancer, with a serious illness, and they added formal palliative care to those patients, as opposed to sort of the traditional way of the oncologist handling the symptoms. And patients that added palliative care to their chemotherapy regimens and sort of to their fight, if you will, actually lived longer and had decreased symptoms.
Wow.
Now, that's not to say that palliative care makes everybody live longer at all. We don't really know what's in the syringe all the time because it's not standard. Everyone does it differently. But to be able to sort of change the narrative to choosing to do palliative care or full force care to saying, we're just adding it. We're an extra layer of support for your symptoms, for your stress. We're adding that to whatever illness it is you have side by side, alongside, not just at the end of life. That's kind of where we're going with palliative care. That's sort of what it is, and dispelling that misconception that it's only for the end of life.
And can I just, let me just go ahead and dispel any thought that if I'm ever in that situation where I'm needing palliative care, I won't be resisting it.
Okay. I'll write that down. I'm trying to keep track of everybody and write it down.
I don't like pain, okay?
And those people don't. And that's something that's really important to talk to your family about, even before you have a serious illness.
Right.
Because you may never get one. But to sort of say, what is important to you? There's a great document called, it's called Five Wishes. And in some way it's good, in some way it's bad. But there's lots of literature about sort of how do you talk to your family about your goals of care? What's important to you? And for some people it is, no matter what, I want you to do everything. I want to be on a ventilator. I want everything done because I worry that doctors might be great prognosticators. I don't have a crystal ball. I'd have a different job if I did and make a lot more money. But it's talking to your family about what you do want and what you don't want and what's important to you. And our job as palliative care doctors, and as any doctor, is to figure that out and then make sure whatever we plan treatment-wise meets those goals and values that you've expressed.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, we got about 2 minutes left. Jason's not here, but do you want to play Dial Catechism?
I do.
All right, I'm going to spin up the Dial Catechism wheel. We'll go between 1 and 2865. See if we can get Alex going with our dial. There we go. There's our music. 1814.
1814. I haven't got that far. I'm in the 1200s, I think.
And this is not the paragraph that we will not read on the air.
I don't even know what that paragraph is.
We'll see. Jason and I know.
And
it's not because we don't agree with it. It's about faith. Faith is the theological virtue by which we believe in God and believe all that He has said and revealed to us, and that Holy Church proposes for our belief because He is truth itself. By faith, man freely commits his entire self to God. For this reason, the believer seeks to know and do God's will. The righteous shall live by faith. Living faith works through charity. Faith, I'm sure, I mean, this has been a part of your life for a long time.
It has been.
How does it affect your work as a physician?
I think there, in medicine and in palliative care, there's a lot of gray, and there's a lot of questions that you can't always answer, especially in the work that I do, where you're sometimes having to make really hard decisions about what happens next. And having faith that there's a bigger plan, having faith that at the end of the day, practicing that virtue, even in the midst of doubt, because there is a lot of doubt about in what we do, that could be really reassuring. And learning what it looks like to have faith is something I have to practice every day.
Well, Jessica, time always flies by. Thanks for being here. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
And yeah, absolutely. And thanks for your great work and for your witness in what you do.
You.
We'll be back Monday by God's grace. Hope you have a great weekend and continue on through the second Sunday of Advent. This is the Mike Allen Show. You've been listening to Breadbox Media.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.